a welcome to whoever's listening. But people are very unstable, very vulnerable. These presentations can make people very vulnerable. And I will be touching on some of this. But as an example, I can be going down a corridor and I'll say hello to a particular patient, you know, Elizabeth or whatever it is. I'll say, oh, hi, Elizabeth, in a very low-key way so as not to overwhelm her. And she might just turn around and, excuse the French, tell me to fuck off. Now, that happens. She's a place somewhere inside her head, you know, and I'll say, no problem, no problem, and I'll kind of scuttle away. Now, it might be about 3 or 4 days later, she'll come back, and I think, what's wrong with her? And she'll want to say, I'm so sorry I said that to you. And so, and I said, look, it's okay. You were in a terrible place. So it's about being non-judgmental, being totally supportive and enabling. Another example is, I don't know if you've heard about CBT for psychosis. It's an intervention, obviously, if someone's experiencing hallucinations, delusions, etc. And maybe I'll be walking down the corridor and I'll see one of the ladies or gents and I'll say, oh, how are you today, Bunty, or whatever. And she'll say, oh, terrible, terrible. And I'll say, well, you know, what's happening for you today? What is it? And she'll maybe say to me, oh, I smell, you know, and she becomes so vulnerable about this. She's quite delusional in her thinking, maybe depressed, and she believes this is what's happening. She's got some process going on inside her body, and it's making her smell, and you can imagine the impact that has on someone. They don't want to engage with anyone. They want to keep out of the way. They want to... So a way of dealing with that is not saying, oh, good grief, of course you don't smell. You don't do that at all, you know. It's more, it's their reality. So you have to respect that that's their reality. But you have to do a bit of a reality testing in a very gentle, respectful way. So you would maybe say, I'm not actually picking anything up. And I haven't noticed anyone, you know, reacting to you or... And did you have a shower this morning? So you're asking on, you maybe say yes. And so you're trying to chip away a wee bit about that horrible belief that, you know, this is how she's presenting. So it's a kind of constant challenge, you know, every time you walk around the corner. But that's, I guess, I suppose, a wee bit about how passionate I am about working there. I feel it really is a deep privilege to work with people who are so vulnerable. Sometimes you get a band 5 qualifying and coming out, as you will. And you've probably seen this as well, if you don't mind me kind of drawing you into it. But so there you are, you're mega enthusiastic. You want to get those goals established and get those treatment plans done. But what I say to them and I say to the students is, whatever you do, just go. This patient can barely tolerate any contact, so just go and be with them. Just respectfully be with them for maybe 1 minute and then withdraw, but reassure them that you're interested in how they're doing. You know they don't want to engage just now, but then you can withdraw. Maybe the next day go back and say, oh, hi, how are you doing today? So it's a kind of respectful way. But sometimes if you're in a therapy session, it's enough just to actually sit with the person and something will come out maybe, or something will evolve, rather than saying, right, we're in this session, we're going to be setting goals, and they don't get a chance to tell you what's on their mind. They might have suicidal ideation, they might be deeply fearful of some of the other people in the war because they're paranoid. So you need to give therapy time to, you know, develop. Is everyone still with me? Are you okay? I really do respect the fact you're tired. I've been out working this morning. I've done 2 home assessments and I'm really feel quite exhausted myself. So I do accept that. This next bit with the slides is maybe a wee bit dry, but Chris asked me just to cover some kind of conditions. So the first one's OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. But I'm not going to labour that. And I did have a case study, but we're not doing that one today. What we'll do is we'll then go on to depression. So the slides don't take too long, but if I have to expand on anything, I will. Let's see. So it's a discussion of these disorders with reference to the ICD-10, the International Statistical Classification of Diagnoses. I'm probably speaking to the converted, and I do apologise. And I thought if, while we're talking about this, we just, and the eventual case study, we just keep these, the POP headings in mind. So inpatient mental health setting, the OT is a valued member of staff on the MDT, multidisciplinary team. We assess the impact of the current illness episode on occupational performance. We adopt a holistic approach to assessment and intervention, and we work in a person-centred and collaborative way. That's all a given, really, isn't it? The process is underpinned by core OT skills of activity analysis, effective observation skills, knowledge of your communication and interaction skills, and we're always grading things, as you know. It's a graded paced approach, and it's all based on evidence-based practice. Like, we do a lot of psychological therapies now, and I know Chris talked about the behavioural activation. I'm the trainer for that, and we just delivered it to our new band fives last week. And that's obviously, we want them to work to model, it's evidence-based, and we're measuring outcomes after the service users have gone through that therapy. So we want to work in an evidence-based way. The clinical work is supported by use of the MOHO tools, AMPS, ACES, MOHOST, OSA, Canadian Occupational Performance Measure. Has everyone encountered one of these at least and used them maybe in your work? So maybe don't need to expand on that, but you know, you can go to the MOHO website and there's some even videos, etc., you can look at to see how to administer the assessments. But if anyone wants any more information about them, I've got more information. We use a model called the K-RAIMS model, and it's to help us make clinical decisions. It's a clinical risk assessment tool, and helps us decide if we've got a duty of care. Did you use that at here, Myers? Good. Has anyone else heard of that K-RAIMS model? Good. I can let you see some paper. In fact, I could maybe actually, as I'm talking, pass this round, and there's a pathway. But basically, we look at assess the patient, and we decide, is there a role for me here? Do I have a duty of care? Because clinically, there's a lot of risk for them because of their presenting problem or issue. And then we decide which caring would meet their need. So I would maybe start off with investigation, and it helps you articulate what the presenting problem is, and where at the end of this episode you hope they'll be after your intervention. And then it gives you an opportunity to say, the intervention is going to be like this, maybe see Fred 3 times a week, start off trying to get him up out of bed earlier, maybe start with a breakfast session, building up to, you know, trying to get them more tolerant of engaging in everyday routine. So, and then at the end of that, you think, well, have I achieved that? You write down whether you've achieved it, and then you move on to the next. So you would assess and then hopefully get them participating in life again on the ward and then obviously at home. So all these strategies enable the OT to conduct a meaningful dialogue with patients and carers, because you're always thinking, you're always trying to PR OT. Really got to make it quite clear what OT's about with doctors, nurses, CPNs. It's exhausting because it's not an easy thing to articulate sometimes. I guess you've found that out. But obviously in that paperwork you can articulate the rationale for OT, you can verbalise the rationale to the actual service user, you can bring their family on board and say, this is why we're doing OT. It gives you a rationale. It ensures, using something like that, ensures that the intervention is focused and specific, It helps us articulate the rationale, as I say, provide timely and cost-effective service, because it's all about money, PR the role and ensure that they have, it's all evidence-based, because we're audited in all this. So diagnostic knowledge, knowledge of psychiatric diagnosis. Sorry, I'll just... We're getting there, right? I've got these £1 glasses, forgive me. The knowledge of psychiatric diagnosis is essential. There is, however, as we know at this stage in your training, a complex interaction between the diagnosed health condition and the individual and personal and environmental contextual factors. These dimensions are dynamic and interactive, and the emphasis of therapeutic intervention is on functional ability, and we identify the strengths and limitations of the function at that time. Life roles and occupations, it's been defined as, well, we know, Christensen, Clark, Kielhoffner, etc. It's about engaging in culturally meaningful, productive daily living and leisure roles, and in the stream of time, and in the physical and social contact of context of one's personal world. Is this all old hat to you? Have you heard it all before? I just can't present it in any other way, really, you know, because, but if you, it never, it always helps just to revisit it briefly. And you know about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So we get people coming in that just need a place of safety, you know. And that we look at the motivation to engage, and then we help them work up the scale if we can. So the anxiety disorder classification, here we are. And there's quite a list of them, including phobic anxiety disorders, obsessive compulsive, which I focus on just now, reaction to stress, adjustment disorders, dissociative conversion disorders, somatoform disorders, and other neurotic disorders. I guess you've heard of all of those, have you? Somatoform, I just hope this is just unfortunate for you, you're at the front. That is when, like, emotional pain is expressed as physical pain. Like, I've got a patient on the ward just now, and he's suffered a bereavement, but he's constantly coming to us saying, oh, my back, or oh, there's something wrong with my foot, or oh, there's something going on inside. And it's like the way emotional distress impacts on the body. So you will hear depressed people and anxious people complaining about things happening to their body. I suppose we're all just one system and that's it. It's not a single condition. It's an umbrella term used for a group of related conditions. And each of these disorders expresses slightly different symptoms. Each calls for different treatments and diagnostic guidelines. That, the international classification of function, the one that you use, am I right? Okay, classification of functioning disability and health, where you're looking at the, it kind of integrates the medical and social aspects of a health condition. Have you heard that before? Have you used that with reference when you're looking at PEOP, that type of classification? I'll maybe say, have I got that? Let me see. I'll hand that round. But it talks about conditions, and it tells you the kind of things that happen to the person physically, emotionally, etc., when they've got that condition. Whereas that classification I was talking about, the ICD-10, doesn't. It just tells you the criteria for the actual illness. So I know the last time I spoke, when the students were doing PEOP, this is what they used. I was told to focus on that in the lecture. So each of these disorders expresses slightly different symptoms, and each calls for different treatments. So we all know that, everyone's still with me, or that classification is called the ICF. Maybe look that up. So to experience some degree of anxiety is normal, as we all know. Anxiety is normal human reaction in certain situations. It can drive behaviours towards positive goals, you know, going for that job interview, It can alert us to danger and cause us to take protective and positive actions by preparing us for flight or fright. You know, the adrenaline starts to go and people run away, or, you know, it gives kind of pumps into the muscles and people have got more physical energy at that point to run away from a frightening situation. It becomes abnormal when it interferes with day-to-day activities. Pathological anxiety, that's when it becomes a kind of definable illness. This is anxiety unattached to an identifiable cause. It's when anxiety exists out of proportion to a stressful situation. It persists after the situation has passed, and it's a response to a vague and an internal unknown threat. It appears for no apparent reason, and it involves distorted, faulty, and counterproductive thinking, which perpetuates the anxiety and can lead to avoidance behaviours. People stop engaging and start to avoid life because it's easier for them, it's less stressful. The etiology, the cause of it, there's no single cause, but it's thought to be an interaction between biological and, you know, like all the chemical neurotransmitters in your brain, and particularly serotonin, and one called norepinephrine, which isn't up there. There can be deficiencies in the level of these neurotransmitters. It can be due to genetic factors. There can be a mental illness in the family. It can be due to psychosocial factors, family dynamics, relationship stresses and strains. It can be due to an individual's life experiences, maybe separation from their carer when they were young, disturbed attachment, maybe arising from trauma, disrupted relationships with the parent. It could be bullying, it could be sexual abuse, it can be a whole range of trauma. Is everyone still kind of engaged? All right. Treatment and interventions. So antidepressants, it's usually, SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, like antidepressants that we use that affect the serotonin level and stop that becoming depleted. Anxiolytics, something to take the edge off the anxiety. A lot of these can be addictive, like diazepam or, you know, lorazepam. So they try to keep them to a minimum just to take the edge off, and they're for short term use. There's days gone by where people would be prescribed diazepam, I'm sure you've heard of it, Valium, for years and years, you know. No one wants that. Neuroleptics, sometimes if they're really severely anxious, they might get an antipsychotic. And beta blockers, because it's affecting their autonomic nervous system, maybe get racing heart, sweating, palpitations. So these beta blockers, which are used for heart conditions, etc., are useful. CBT, maybe not behavioural therapy at that stage, but a behavioural approach, not a behavioural activation therapy for this diagnosis, certainly not at that stage. That was a mistake to go in there. But a behavioural approach to try and get them to re-engage with meaningful occupations and overcome their fear. Anxiety management, maybe graded exposure, relaxation therapy, and making sure they take their medication once they're out the ward. And some common symptoms are persistent state of apprehension, inner tension and nervousness, catastrophic thinking, or if I do this, such and such will happen, or if I don't do this, if I don't touch this light, you know, this piece of the table, you know, six times, or touch that light switch six times, something terrible is going to happen to my family. It's a wee bit like when we were kids, we didn't want to walk in the cracks of the pavement, but it's just that multiplied a million times. I had one patient, and he couldn't. He lived at home with his mother, and he had had a traumatic experience in his background. But it was just he and his mother, and we tried to get him out to a house of his own. We tried to support him in so many things. But he also had his mother doing a lot of these rituals as well. So she was completely in thrall of this illness as well. But he actually got a wee, you know, the wee fine watercolour paintbrushes? Lovely wee sable watercolour paintbrush. And he was actually painting his bedroom wall with this. He would never get it finished, but the anxiety was phenomenal. His mother had to take out the furniture from the side of the wall every day to clean in a specific manner. It's really exhausting illness. I got him to do a drawing on one occasion to try and represent his thoughts, and it was just I didn't bring it today. That might have been an interesting part, but it was an absolute mass of incoherence to me. It was all squiggles and occasional number, and he was trying to tell me what this was all about. It obviously meant something to him. It was a but to me, it was an absolute representation of the chaos in his mind and how disordered his thoughts were. Some common symptoms, other physical symptoms, muscle tension, headaches, fatigue, insomnia, nausea, hyperventilation, dizziness. I think we've covered some of those already. The dizziness, pounding heart. So that was a case study, but let's just see. So has anyone encountered someone with OCD in your clinical placements? Young people sometimes do, you know, it's around about exam time sometimes. Students obviously get very anxious. How did it manifest for?
She was just very, like, she got everything straight to me, and it got to the stage where she actually like losing her hands. She used to wash her hands so much, and they were so dry. Then she actually fell pregnant, and a lot of it went away.
Really? That's interesting. Did she ever need to get treatment for it though, or was it just something that was?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's excellent. But yeah, I mean that can be that people put on and take off a shoe. They press a light button about 15 times, and if they don't do that, some dreadful catastrophe. You can just see how that impacts massively in someone's life. Did you?
And he would do it like a certain number of times, and then he would sit and he did this every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So you'd be like, do it, like it was a community, so you'd be like trying to do like a kitchen task with him.
Very difficult.
Every 10 minutes you'd have to stop and have to do this like I think it's 30 times.
Yeah.
Turn his water in the dress.
Yeah. I know.
So apparently there was like a stage where he was like really, really severe.
So that was progress. The very fact that you were doing a kitchen assessment was major progress.
Yeah.
But you could see how it intrudes. And I mean, if you do something, although to do an AMPS assessment, which has all these rules attached to it, and you're not allowed to speak to the patient, and you've to stand back and observe, that's quite intrusive. You know, that's quite stressful for a lot of people. And I guess you wouldn't maybe be putting someone who's in an inpatient ward with OCD through that, one of these standardised assessments. But that was major progress for him. But yeah, you can just see how crippling this is. We've got one man who comes in, and when he's out at home again, it seems to be a contextual thing. It seems to be when it's he and his mum, and they've got a really kind of quite enmeshed relationship. And she has even reduced her work hours to stay at home more, to almost accommodate all his rituals and routines. So she is exhausted by this, and she's getting older. And the interesting thing is, it reaches a peak out in the community, and then he gets admitted to the ward, and I can't see OCD symptoms shortly after admission. It just seems to be happening in that context. So you almost feel, you know, when you want to say to the mum, no, you have to go out and you have to go back to your job full time and get a bit of enjoyment and pleasure in your life. So it's not easy. So I'll maybe just a few wee ones and then we'll go into the depression because I'm mindful of the time. So a person can experience they can experience depression leading to suicidal thoughts. That's a kind of comorbid thing, you know, they come in with OCD but they've obviously got depression. It's like they come in with alcohol problems but they're depressed as well. So you've got these comorbid, or they come in with a schizophrenic episode, but they've also now got a drink problem because they've been trying to cope by, you know, they've got ineffective coping strategies. Maybe start to drink to dull down some of the voices. So this all creates a major problem, and then they're addicted to alcohol before we know it. So they can experience that. Obsessive thoughts, what we call ruminations, impulses or images enter their mind again and again in stereotyped form, and they are recognised by the person as his own thoughts. It's not like, you know, with a person with a psychotic illness, they maybe think what's coming into their mind is either put there by someone else or it's the voice of God. Someone with OCD knows it's their own thoughts. Compulsions can be repetitive mental acts or behaviours performed in response to, obsessive preoccupations. They're carried out in order to reduce discomfort or to prevent a dreaded event happening. And some common symptoms, excessive hand washing, as you said yourself, that was to the point where everything's all broken down and they're scalding their hands to kind of get rid of germs. And repeated checking, aversion to particular numbers, preoccupation with religious thoughts, and rituals such as opening and closing doors. Such symptoms can cause social alienation, physical exhaustion, and emotional distress, with marked impact on the person's lifestyle and relationships. How could they ever have a boyfriend? How could they ever have a girlfriend? You know, how could they go back to work? It's so crippling. So what I'll do just now is, does anyone want to ask anything about that? Or it kind of speaks for itself, doesn't it? Yes. I think they do realise that, but it's just compelling.
Yeah.
So it's in the kind of...
They
know it's maybe irrational, but their fear is so deep of this other catastrophe happening that it's so hard just to intervene in that. You can see them exhausted, but yes, I think, you know, they're recognising, but... It's their coping strategy as well, isn't it? To ward off this deep, deep anxiety. It must be awful. Going on to the mood disorder, and this is a case study, and there's not many more slides for this, and then we can talk about the case study, i.e. how we'd actually do the occupational therapy. So classification again, the case study's a depressive episode. So mood disorder isn't a single condition, it's a group of disorders, with each disorder expressing slightly or more markedly in, for example, bipolar affective disorder and mania. It expresses different symptoms. Each calls for different diagnostic and treatment guidelines. So mood disorders are very common, and they have a high level of morbidity and mortality and an immense impact on functional ability. But we do a risk assessment before the patient comes into the ward, and we find out, are they suicidal? How seriously suicidal are they? Do they have a plan? If some come in and they articulate a really clear plan, someone went out and bought wee craft knives and then looked up all the anatomy websites and decided where the best place, and when she was being assessed before admission, you know, she was able to say that, because it's not a case of, you don't avoid the subject. Every session I have with a patient, I'll say, do you have any suicidal thoughts? And initially that can take a bit of courage, because you think, oh, am I sparking them? Am I provoking suicidal thoughts by asking that question? But actually, by asking it opens the doorway. They can say, well, actually, they'll often say to me, well, I'm thinking about it, but not as often. And I'll say, well, when you're thinking about it, do you have a plan? And they'll say, oh, no, no, I just wish I wasn't here in general. So you've got to probe, and, you know. And if they're out in the community and they're suicidal, you have to see, can this be helped in the community by extra support? Can it be, or are they seriously saying to you that they can't guarantee their safety and therefore you would bring them into the ward? But you have to keep asking the question and monitor it. And we do risk assessment every day where we'll score them high, low, medium or whatever. Because the last thing you want them doing is going off the ward and then committing suicide, because, you know, it occasionally happens. I had one case, it was a young girl, she was foreign. She couldn't express herself very well, but I think she'd been bottling all this up on the ward, regardless of, you know, people trying to probe into it and check out how she was. But she came into the OT session, and maybe because it's more relaxed setting, she tried to express herself and she really did crumble. And I thought, no, you really are actively suicidal. And she'd said to me, when she goes home, I'm going to do suicide. So I thought, right, I've got a duty of care here to make it quite clear to the treatment team what's been said. So I'd reported to the nurse in charge. I then recorded it on our electronic system, because I thought, you cannot take, you know, you have to cover your back, but also for her safety. And I'd said, she's really quite active expressing this. Anyway, I'd gone off, and after I'd done all that, and I'd done what I had to do, but then I'd gone off on sick leave shortly after that, and I had got a phone call to say that this girl had killed herself. But I know it sounds appalling. I had covered myself, I had recorded all that. It was so sad. But I thought, now I've done my duty by her, and I've shared it with my colleagues. Now, whatever happened after that, maybe she then denied it, maybe she then, I don't know. But she got off that ward, and she, you know. So you've got to be so careful, because if I hadn't done that, you know, that we still had a massive inquiry, obviously, you know. So these things can happen. Where was I? So unipolar, these are characterised by depression only, and that's what this case study's about. And it's a mood disorder which is seen as a constant disturbance of mood. And the bipolar presentation, this involves fluctuations between moods of manic depression, mania and depression. I've been in a kitchen with someone who's coming down from hypomania, and the impact on their functional ability. I've actually felt at the end of the session that I've actually had to breathe for them, because the speed of the tasking, and maybe experienced it, but is incredible, and no matter what you try to do, you can't slow them down. So we think very, very carefully before we think very carefully about what tasking we're going to get them to do, and usually what it should be is absolute calming, you know, de-stressing. But that was evident, you know, just how, and okay, the task was done to phenomenal expertise in half the time it would take anyone else. But as I say, I was left thinking, I started to kind of draw breath for her. I thought it was making me breathless. So, the case study, clinical presentation, display individual variations. Anxiety can be evident in some cases with evidence of motor agitation. They're restless, they're agitated, they're moving about. The mood change can be masked by added features such as excessive alcohol consumption, and maybe drinking to cope with the depression, which will make them more depressed in turn, because alcohol, the depressant. Exacerbation of existing obsessions and phobias. if these are normally low key, if the person starts to become depressed, they can become a bit more to try and control their situation. Hypochondriacal preoccupations, histrionic behaviour and irritability. I had one lady who, it's one gent, he had a really deep, deep depression, and he believed he had a terminal illness, and he thought he had cancer, and he was saying goodbye to all his family and preparing for this painful death. Now, he didn't, because obviously you got all the physical assessments done, and he ended up getting ECT, and it really did help him massively. But, that's psychotic depression, where they become really quite delusional and believe that they're going to die, they've got a terminal illness. It must be awful for them. So this episode that this case study has was characterised by depressed mood, loss of enjoyment and interest in activity, anhedonia, reduced self-esteem, reduced attention and concentration, reduced emotional reactivity, unworthiness and guilt feelings, a pessimistic perception of the future, and ideas or acts of self-harm, deliberate self-harm or suicide, and obviously it all impacts. And you'll all have come across someone with depression, I would imagine, in your clinical. And somatic symptoms associated with this, the physical symptoms, reduced energy levels, becoming very easily fatigued, marked tiredness after only slight effort, early morning wakening, that's called diurnal variation, depression, maybe worse in the morning, loss of appetite, weight loss of sex drive, and objective evidence of psychomotor retardation. Their minds slowed down, their bodies slowed down. Or they might be the opposite, they might be agitated and get no peace and relaxation. And a severe case can have some psychotic symptoms developing, as I've just described. But these can maybe be hallucinations, auditory, perceptual disturbance, thinking they've been touched, angry, derogatory voices talking about them, maybe a difference in the sense of smell, which obviously that lady I was talking about earlier had, delusions, depressive stupor, where they're really not moving much at all. They really are so incapacitated by this, and incongruent mood. Maybe if someone's depressed, you might get people that display a congruent mood with the depression, all these negative thinkings, guilt, or there might be incongruent mood. So they may be talking about something, a bereavement or a death, but they'll be laughing. They'll have a kind of incongruent presentation to their mood. And the treatment, we're getting to the end of this. So you've got, antidepressants, obviously, which alter the neurotransmitters. They can be in oral form. If someone's not good at taking medication, you've heard about them getting a depot injection, intramuscular. If there's insomnia or anorexia present, they require more sedating antidepressant. Some of them have got sedative effect. Patients experiencing lethargy, weight gain, lower levels of anxiety may require less sedating medications. Those with recurrent depression need long-term maintenance so that they don't relapse, and that's where the behavioural activation that Chris was talking about comes in, for mild to moderate depression, not so much severe, and electroconvulsive therapy. They don't exactly know how it works, but it really can work. Right. And, psychosocial interventions, obviously OT, behavioural therapy for when things are less severe, family therapy, psychotherapy, CBT. We've got peer support workers in the ward. They've had mental illness themselves, so they can be a great support in the recovery, talk with the patient, and be an example that I came out the other end. I survived this. Prodromal monitoring, you've heard of that? it's relapse prevention, where you do a relapse plan. Like if the patient's family or the patient themselves think they're starting to become unwell again, then you've made a plan to say, contact the CPN, go to the GP, phone your support worker, you know, go for a medication review or whatever. You want to try at all costs to try and avoid them coming into the hospital. So, right. So this case study, and we're nearly at the end. Thank you for bearing with me. I've done some kind of paperwork for you, so you can take it away, you know, and at least if you're having problems with your concentration at the moment and your attention at this time of the day, it's totally understandable. Now, so, if you could just say about 40 of you, or if you're more, if you take maybe, you know, one of each of these and pass them round. Who doesn't have one? Can it just kind of describes. I'll talk while you're doing that. So the OT process, we all know about the OT process, hopefully by now. And within my setting, that's about assessing the impact of the current episode of illness on their occupational performance. We want to, obviously, we watch how we're phrasing this. We don't want to say we're going to look at the things you can't do. We're going to look at your strengths and the things that are challenging you at the moment regarding your occupational performance. We give a rationale to get them on board, and we do that with all the psychological therapies as well. You tell them what OT is about and why it's going to be beneficial to them, or it could be. And you say that you're going to tailor the treatment intervention to their needs. See if I can get rid of that just now. During the assessment, you're keeping in mind all the kind of hierarchy of needs, what things have been met, what aren't. So it's collaborative, and you start off by setting short-term treatment goals, moving to the longer-term treatment goals, obviously. That's coming after your initial assessment, and you would have used that Cairns episode sheet to articulate your assessment outcomes and make your treatment plan. And it's all evidence, it's all underpinned by evidence-based practice, or it should be. And we're doing it in a graded, paced manner so that the patient isn't overwhelmed and completely ready to implode. What we're doing as well is we're constantly reinforcing their progress, and it might even be they haven't made much behavioural progress, but they might be saying, oh, I'm starting to see, I'm now able to take my meals round in the dining room on the ward rather than at my bedside. So you're constantly reinforcing progress or positive, you know, response to your intervention. And in a ward, it can be extremely, you know, small steps. And then, ultimately, you want to help them transfer these skills out into the community. And we start that as soon as we can. What we say to the patients when they come into the ward, as an occupational therapist here, it's my job to help you prepare for discharge. So you're kind of saying we're working towards discharge. I know you're just in, but we're working towards discharge in a graded manner. So, right, so this lady, let's see, so this lady had a, let's, I wonder what one it is, maybe, I wonder if I've given out, I should have kept one of them for myself, could I please, just to make sure I've got the right thing here, right. So the lady of the, she had a psychiatric history of clinical depression, with associated suicidal ideation. I'm sure it's me that's not that funny. Has anything exciting happened? He's what?
He just walked in at the door.
Oh, did he? Oh, I didn't even notice. I should have been assessing the motor skills. Right. So as long as I know it's not what I'm saying, but. So, psychiatric history of clinical depression with associated suicidal ideation and a three previous overdose attempts. and to the member of a large family, two sisters, three brothers, and two step-siblings. I don't know if I've actually got that down there. Let's see. Her husband works as a bookkeeper. I wonder if... What I'll maybe do is I'll just move... I'll put that aside because that's maybe repeating what I was going to say here. So at the time of admission, this woman was expressing this suicidal ideation. She didn't have a plan to carry this out, but she was very depressed. During interview, she displayed limited eye contact, flat affect. Do you know the difference between mood and affect? You hear that? You hear people talking about that? Affect, when you were out in placement. I suppose mood is something that's kind of been there, like there's been a depressed mood for quite a long time, but affect is how they're responding now. So maybe mood is like the season and affect is like the weather on that particular day. Oh, you okay? Yep. But does that make sense to you? So they might be depressed, but on a particular day when you go to see them, they might be a bit more upbeat, so their affect's a bit more, or they might be a bit more withdrawn or blunted. So you kind of record the affect when you see them. Anyway, so she displayed a poverty of thought content. She was really depressed. And at the point of admission, for some period afterwards, her illness was assessed to have markedly impacted on her safety, social, communication, motor and information processing. Motivation and volition to engage in anything was down as well. She was withdrawing from kind of rewarding daily activities and things that she would previously have enjoyed. She even wasn't attending to her personal hygiene and a proper diet. So we based it all on the model of human occupation. She had a mini mental state examination, which, have you seen that before, a mini mental state? So it looks at, you know, the memory, verbal fluency, spatial awareness, etc. So her mini mental, she'd reduced attentional skills, and she just couldn't concentrate, you know. And this was all indicating an experience of anxiety and depression. And she also had a depression scale administered as well. So the assessment, let me just see. So initial screening was carried out to identify any need for OT intervention using the MOHOST tool. You know that, you've heard of that, haven't you? I've asked that. Once the need was identified, contact with Mrs. A was established on a regular basis. And this took place firstly at her bedside, because she really wasn't well enough to get up at that point. And the aim at this stage was to establish a therapeutic rapport. And there was the expectation of a supportive therapeutic relationship from the therapist, as we said before. So that was kind of the being with her part. But also saying, I'm still here, we're going to be coming back, and we're going to support you. Observation of her communication skills, and we're using active, reflective listening skills when we are speaking with her. Support was given to encourage expression of preoccupations and concerns. And we used this a lot of the time to allow her to enable her to express herself. And, what did he say? P. Oh, I don't know what it was. So we wanted her to be able to talk, and what did he say? There was something he said, press. I don't know what that was. Progress was P, wasn't it? But I don't know what the other one was. Escape. Anyway, it's not happening. So we wanted to give her an opportunity to express herself and see how she was feeling. And was she suicidal, etc. There were marked emotional and biological symptoms associated with this presentation, but she displayed a degree of resistance and an urge to avoid engagement. When you're not feeling well, when you're feeling lousy, you don't want to engage. And the above-described approach at this stage was used to gently influence her motivation and get her to participate in the therapy. Contact then progressed to brief, planned and negotiated sessions off the ward in the OT department. Her assessment of mental state continued, with ongoing support to allow her to express herself and her unhappiness and grief. Then we looked at, you know, what are her usual habits and routines, etc. And we used some of these the MOHO tools to do the same. Ability to respond to this assessment approach was dictated by her psychological, physical and emotional status at the time. As engagement continued, an improvement occurred and she started to respond to medication as well. We offered other therapeutic interventions. She was better able to tolerate further standardised functional assessment. Now, I think maybe that case study I've given you, I've just got it in a larger form. So she was better able to tolerate as she became a wee bit better, and then she was able to engage in the doing familiar activity part. And following the assessment period, a treatment plan was established based on the assessment outcomes, and this was done in a collaborative way and was informed by making a formulation about what the problems were. One-to-one context, and sometimes we would do peer tasking with her. When it was too much to actually get her to do the tasking on her own, we would do peer tasking, just so that she could have some sense of achievement. So then it moved to her carrying out sex activities at the appropriate time of day. So we would maybe try and get her up for breakfast. We would, if she couldn't manage that, we'd try and get her up for a lunch to try and make that, or try and participate in making that. All the time success and positive outcomes were reinforced. Self-esteem began to slowly improve, and she was better able to express her feelings and benefit from the supportive relationship. Then we could increase the complexity and challenge of it all and get her to engage more. So I think it kind of speaks for itself, and you can digest that, but basically what we were doing was moving the treatment slowly away from the bedside into the OT department, from the OT department out into the community, from there then maybe to a brief home pass, and all the time we were translating the skills that she had worked on and kind of regained, we were trying to transplant those back into the community. And then she would get longer periods of time at home and be introduced to the CPN or the community OT, and basically, you know, we would support her in trying to re-engage with meaningful occupations there. And then further down the line, it might be, you know, she could have participated in behavioural activation, psychological therapy, but then we might get vocational rehab involved a wee bit further down the line to see if she could think about maybe taking up again a work-related occupation, or just something that would, down the line, help her maybe go back to work, because this lady had previously had a job. So we also felt we needed to do some psychoeducation with the family so that they could better understand how to cope with this, and relapse prevention, some prodromal monitoring, etc. So that's basically the horse. Because of the short notice I've had, I guess maybe you've got all those concepts and things in your head, but hopefully if maybe just revisiting was a wee bit helpful. And although I've kind of run out of steam, the case study is quite good and quite comprehensive, so it might be helpful. So does anyone have anything to... You don't feel you have to ask anything. No, but nothing really. So I think that's not bad for timing, actually, is it? That's pretty good. I kind of got from... So obviously these conditions are long-term conditions, a lot of them, and people will just come back into the ward. But we're trying to, just more robust community treatment, and only if they're really very unwell do we bring them into the acute admissions ward now. Just try to get more and more... And we've got the community clinics, I think Chris told you about that, didn't he? So we've got that, and lots of other you know, kind of joint partnership working, like the council and learning services, etc., peer support, just everything to try and keep the people embedded in the community. But I think that's maybe enough. Thank you very much.